As much as he loves anything in life, the Chinese electrical engineer who brings his family into the garage to make long-distance calls to their Virginia grandparents on a car phone bigger than a Yule log loves his national parks. Winston Ma spends half a year planning the annual June ritual, marking up maps, underlining guidebooks, taking neat notes into scores of pocket notebooks, and tying strange trout flies that look like tiny Chinese New Year dragons. By November, the dining room table is so full of preparation that the family must eat their Thanksgiving meal, clams and rice, in the breakfast nook. Then vacation comes, and they're off again. The five of them crammed into the sky-blue Chevy Biscayne with roof rack and back seat as wide as a continental shelf, no air conditioning, and a cooler full of juice on ice, logging thousands of miles on trips to Yosemite, Zion, Olympic, and beyond. This year, they return to his beloved Yellowstone. Every campground along the way gets an entry in Winston's notebooks. He writes down the campsite number and evaluates it according to a dozen different criteria. He'll use the data over the winter to perfect next year's route. He makes the girls practice their musical instruments in the back seat. This is easier for Mimi on trumpet and Carmen on clarinet than for little Amelia and her violin. They forget to pack books. 2,000 miles with nothing to read. The two older girls stare at their little sister for dozens of Nebraska miles until Amelia breaks down and cries. It passes the time. Charlotte gives up trying to control them. No one suspects yet, but she has already begun to slip into the long, private place that each passing year will deepen. She sits in the front seat, navigating maps for her husband, and humming Chopin nocturnes under her breath. Dementia starts here, in these days of quiet, automotive sainthood. They camp near Slough Creek for 3 days. The younger girls spend hours playing old maid. Mimi joins her father in the stream. The shared lassitude of casting, the sea of the line as it lengthens in the air, that four-stroke swelling rhythm with the stiff hands stopping at 10 and 2, the ripple of the dry fly as it alights on the water, her small dread that something might actually strike, the startle of the fish's mouth when it breaks the surface, these are charmed to her and will stay so forever. Knee-deep in the cold current, her father is free. He maps the sandbars, measures the speed of the water, reads the bottom, watches for hatch, those simultaneous equations and multiple unknowns that one must solve to think like a fish, all the while conscious of nothing but the sheer luck of being on the water. "Why these fish hiding?" he asks his daughter. "What they do?" This is how she'll remember him, wading in his heaven. Fishing, he has solved life. Fishing, he passes the final exam. The next Arhat, joining the ones in the mysterious scroll at the bottom of his closet that Mimi has continued to visit in secret over the years. She's old enough now to know that the men in the scroll are not her ancestors, but seeing her father like this, on the river, complete and at peace, she cannot help but think he's their descendant. Charlotte sits in a camping chair by the side of the river. Her only job is to unsnag the lines of the two fishermen, untying Byzantine microscopic knots hour after hour. Winston watches the sun set over the river, the reeds going from gold to dun. "Look the color!" And again, a few minutes later, a whisper to himself under the sky's collapsing cobalt, "Look the color!" There are colors in his spectrum that no one else can see. They picnic on the shores of a small lake not far off the road toward Tower Junction. Mimi and Carmen look for stones to make into jewelry. Charlotte and Amelia begin their 17th consecutive game of Chinese checkers. Winston sits in a foldable camping chair, updating his notebooks. There's a funny motion near the table. Amelia shouts, "Bear!" Charlotte leaps up, sending the game board flying. She lifts her youngest daughter into the air and dashes into the lake. The bear ambles toward the jewelry gatherers. Mimi checks for high shoulders or a sloping face. She must do one thing for grizzlies, the opposite for black bears. One climbs trees, the other doesn't. She can't remember which. "Climb!" she shouts to Carmen, and they each scramble up their own lodgepole. The bear, which could reach either of them in two easy scooches, loses interest. It stands on the lake shore, wondering if today might be a good day for a swim. It regards the chest-deep woman in the water, holding her tiny daughter on high like she's about to baptize the girl. It waits to see what the always insane species will do next. It wanders over to Winston, who has been sitting stock still at the camping table, taking pictures with the Nikon. The camera, the only Japanese item the man allows himself to own, goes click, snick, whirr. Winston rises to his feet as the animal approaches. Then he starts to chatter to the bear. In Chinese. A primitive toilet stands near the site, door open. Winston talks to the bear, cajoling it while edging toward the door. This baffles the bear, who reconsiders his whole approach to the situation. Sadness percolates up in him. He sits and claws at the air. Winston keeps talking. It astounds Mimi, this alien language coming from her father's mouth. Winston draws a handful of pistachios from his pocket and tosses them into the latrine. The bear ambles after them, grateful for the diversion. "Get in car!" Winston's shout whispers. "Fast!" They do, and the bear doesn't even lift its head. But Winston stops to retrieve the camping table and stools. He's paid good money for them, and he's not about to leave them behind. That night, at the campsite near Norris, Mimi asks him, awed. Her father has changed before her eyes. "Weren't you afraid?" He laughs, embarrassed. "Not my time yet. Not my story." The words chill her. How can he know his story ahead of time? But she doesn't ask him that. Instead, she says, "What did you say to it?" His brow crumples. He shrugs. What else is there to say to a bear? "Apologize. I tell him people very stupid. They forget everything. Where they come from, where they go. I say, don't worry. Human being leaving this world very soon. Then the bear get top bunk to himself again." At Holyoke, Mimi is a lug, lesbian until graduation. It's the same at half of the other Seven Sisters colleges, rounded up. Scissors and paste, they call it. Fun, sinning, healthy, shameful, sweet. Great practice for something. Life, say. Whatever happens after school. She reads 19th century American poetry and drinks afternoon tea in South Hadley for 3 semesters. It beats Wheaton. But one April day, she's reading Abbott's Flatland for a sophomore survey called Transcendence, when she reaches the part where the narrator, A. Square, gets lifted out of his plane into the expanses of Spaceland. Truth comes over her like a revelation. The only thing worth believing in is measurement. She must become an engineer, like her daddy before her. It's not even a choice. She's an engineer already, and always has been. And as with Abbott's Square, the minute she comes back to Flatland, her Holyoke friends want to lock her up. She transfers to Berkeley, best place for ceramic engineering she can find. The place is a staggering time warp. Future masters of the universe study alongside unrepentant revolutionaries who believe the golden age of human potential peaked 10 years before. She thrives, reborn Mimi, looking like a diminutive Kazakh carrying a programmable calculator, and in the estimation of many, the cutest thing ever to mouth the Hall-Petch equation. She savors the eerie Stepford Wives climate. She sits in the eucalyptus grove, the trees that explode in the dry heat, solving problem sets and watching the protesters with their placards full of all-caps slogans. The better the weather, the more irate the demands. The month before graduation, she dons a killer interview suit, sleek, gray, professional, inexorable as a no-cal earthquake. She interviews with 8 campus reps and gets 3 offers. She takes a job as a casting process supervisor for a molding outfit in Portland because it offers the most chance to travel. They send her to Korea. She falls in love with the country. In 4 months, she learns more Korean than she knows Chinese. Her sisters, too, wander across the map. Carmen winds up at Yale, studying economics. Amelia gets a job nursing wounded wildlife in a discovery center in Colorado. Back in Wheaton, the Ma mulberry is assailed on all fronts. Mealybugs cover it in cottony wisps. Scale insects mass on its branches, invulnerable to all her father's pesticides. Bacteria blacken the leaves. Her parents are helpless to save the thing. Charlotte, in her thickening fog, murmurs about bringing in a priest to pray over it. Winston pours through horticulture Bibles and fills his notebooks with impeccably printed speculations, but each season brings the tree closer to capitulation. Winston calls Mimi when she's back in Portland from another Korea trip. He reaches her from the family phone booth, the Ma garage. His invention has shrunken down to the size of a hiking boot, so reliable and power thrifty that Bell Labs starts licensing it to other outfits. But Winston takes no pleasure in telling his daughter that his life's work has at last come to fruition. All he can talk about is his failed mulberry.
That tree. What he do?
What's wrong with it, Dad?
Bad color. All his leaves falling.
Have you tested the soil?
My silk farm. Finish. It never make 1 thread.
Maybe you should plant another.
Best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago.
Yep. And you always said the next best time was now.
Wrong. Next best time, 19 years ago.
Mimi has never heard this cheerful, endlessly resourceful man sound so low. Take a trip, Dad. Take Mom camping. But they've just come back from a 10,000-miler up to the salmon streams in Alaska, and the notebooks are filled with meticulous notes that will take years to go over. Put Mom on. There's a sound. The car door opening and closing, then the door to the garage. After a while, a voice says,
Salve, filia mea.
Mom? What the hell?
Ego latinam discunt.
Don't do this to me, Mom.
Vita est supplicium.
Put Dad back on. Dad? Is everything okay out there?
Mimi? My time coming.
What's that supposed to mean?
My work all done. My silk farm finish. Fishing going down. little bit every year. What I do now.
What are you talking about? Do what you've always done. Make charts and graphs of next year's campsites. Fill up the basement with stacks of soap and soup and cereal and any other items that happen to go on sale. Fall asleep every night to the 10 o'clock news. Freedom.
Yes,
he says. But she knows the voice that formed her. Whatever he pretends that yes to mean, it's a lie. She makes a note to call her sisters and discuss the Wheaton collapse. Parents on the fritz. What to do? But long distance to the East Coast is $2 a minute if you don't have a magic shoe phone. She decides to write them both that weekend. But that weekend is her ceramic sintering conference in Rotterdam. And the letters slip her mind. In the fall, with his wife in the basement studying Latin, Winston Ma, once Ma Sir Shin to everyone who knew him, sits under the crumbling mulberry, and, with Verdi's Macbeth blasting out the bedroom window, puts a Smith & Wesson 686 with hardwood grips up to his temple and spreads the workings of his infinite being across the flagstones of the backyard. He leaves no note except a calligraphic copy of Wang Wei's 1,200-year-old poem left unfurled on parchment across the desk in his study. An old man, I want only peace. The things of this world mean nothing. I know no good way to live, and I can't stop getting lost in my thoughts, my ancient forests. The wind that waves the pines loosens my belt. The mountain moon lights me as I play my lute. You ask, how does a man rise or fall in this life? The fisherman's song flows deep under the river. Mimi is in SFO on her way to Seattle for a site inspection. She's mock-shopping the concourse when, out of the cacophony of gate calls and public service announcements, her name blares out. Something cold grabs at her scalp. Before the people at the customer service desk even hand her the phone, she knows. And all the way home to Illinois, she thinks, how do I recognize this already? Why does this all feel so much like remembering? Her mother is helpless.
Your father doesn't want to hurt us. He has some ideas. I don't understand all of them. That's just how he is.
Her words come from a place where the blast she heard from the basement is only one of several possibilities that branching time might try. She looks so gentled, so at peace in her confusion, so utterly under the surface of the flowing river that Mimi can do nothing but share her unreal calm. The job her father leaves is Mimi's to finish. No one has touched the scene, except to remove the body and the gun. Pieces of brain dot the stones and tree trunk, like new species of garden slug. She turns into a cleaning machine, bucket, sponge, soapy water, for the spattered deck. She failed to alert her sisters or stop what she saw happening, but she can do this, clean up the backyard carnage forever. Cleaning, she becomes another thing. The wind loosens her hair. She looks at the bloodied paving stones, the bits of soft tissue that housed his ideas. She sees him by her side, amazed by the flecks of his own brain lying in the grass.
Look, the color!
You ask how people rise or fall in this life? Like this. She sits under the diseased mulberry. Wind slaps at the coarse-toothed leaves. Wrinkles score the bark, like the folds in the Arhat's faces. Her eyes sour with animal confusion. Even now, every square foot of ground is stained with fruit, Fruit stained, the myths say, with the blood of a suicide for love. Words come out of her, crumpled and tinny.
Dad. Daddy. What you do?
Then the silent howls. Carmen and Amelia arrive. United, the trio sit together one last time. They have no explanation. There never will be one. The least likely person in the world has gone on an impossible tour without them. In place of explanation, memory. They put their hands on each other's shoulders and tell each other stories of how things were. Sunday opera, the epic car journeys, trips to the lab where the tiny man floated down the halls, celebrated by all his giant white colleagues, the happy maker of the cellular future. They remember the day the family scattered from the bear, their mother holding Amelia above her head in the water, their father talking to the animal in Chinese, two creatures, not quite of the same order, sharing the same woods. They hold a silent liturgy of memory and shock, but they hold it indoors. Mimi's sisters don't go near the yard. They can't even look at the old breakfast tree, their father's silk farm. Mimi tells them what she knows. The call.
My time coming.
Amelia holds her.
It's not your fault. You couldn't know.
Carmen says, he told you that and you didn't tell us? Charlotte sits nearby, smiling a little. It's like the family is still on a camping trip somewhere, and she is at lakeside, unsnagging the smallest knots in her husband's fishing line.
He hates it when you three fight.
Mom! Mimi shouts at the woman. Mom, enough! Clear your head! He's gone!
Gone?
Charlotte frowns at her daughter's foolishness.
What are you talking about? I'll see your father again.
The three girls attack the mountain of paperwork and reporting. It has never before occurred to Mimi. The law doesn't stop with death. It reaches far beyond the grave, for years, entangling the survivors in bureaucratic hurdles that make the challenges of pre-death seem like a cakewalk. Mimi tells the others, we have to divvy up his stuff. Divvy? Carmen says. You mean, like, take? Amelia says,
shouldn't we let Mom?
You see how she is. She's not even here. Carmen rears up. Can you stop solving problems for a minute? What's the hurry? I'd like to get things done for Mom. By throwing out his stuff? Distribute. Each thing to the right person. Like solving a big quadratic equation. Carmen, we have to take care of it. Why? You want to sell the house out from under Mom? Like she's going to be able to take care of it by herself, in her state? Amelia puts her arms around them both.
Maybe those things can wait for now? We only have a little while to be with each other.
We're all here now, Mimi says. It could be a long time before that happens again. Let's just get it done. Carmen shakes free of the hug. So, you're not coming home for Christmas? But something in her tone is as good as a signed confession. Home has gone wherever their father went. Charlotte clings to a few token things.
This is his favorite sweater. Oh, don't take the waders. And these are the slacks he wears when we go hiking.
She's fine, Carmen says, when the three of them are alone. She's managing. She's just a little weird.
I can come back in a few weeks, Amelia offers. Check in, make sure she's okay.
Carmen faces Mimi, pre-enraged. Don't even dream of putting her in a home. I'm not dreaming anything. I'm just trying to take care of things.
Take care?
Here. You're the compulsive one. Knock yourself out. 11 notebooks filled with report cards on every campsite we've ever stayed in. All yours.
The three opera heroines hover above a silver plate. On the plate are three jade rings. On each ring is a carved tree, and each tree branches in one of time's three disguises. The first is the lote, the tree at the boundary of the past that none may pass back over. The second is that thin, straight pine of the present. The third is Fusang, the future, a magical mulberry far to the east where the elixir of life is hidden. Amelia stares.
Who's supposed to get which one?
There's a right way to do this, Mimi says, and a dozen wrong ones.
Carmen sighs.
Which one is this?
Shut up. Close your eyes. On the count of three, take one. On three, there's some light grazing of arms, and each woman finds her fate. When they open their eyes, the platter is empty. Amelia has her eternal present, Carmen her doomed past, and Mimi is left holding the thin trunk of things to come. She puts it on her finger. It's a little big, gift from a homeland she will never see. She spins the endless loop of inheritance around on her finger like an open sesame. Now, the Buddhas. They don't understand her. But then Amelia and Carmen haven't been thinking about the scroll for the last 17 years.
The Luo Han, Mimi says, butchering the pronunciation.
The Arhats. She rolls the scroll out on the table where their father used to tie his trout flies. It's older, stranger than any of them remembers. Like someone has been reworking it with colors and ink from the world beyond this one.
We could take it to an auction house, split the money.
Meme, Amelia says, didn't he leave us enough money?
Or Mimi could just take it for herself. That would be enlightened.
We could give it to a museum.
In memory of Se Shin Ma. The name sounds hopelessly American in Mimi's mouth.
Amelia says, that would be beautiful.
And we'd have tax write-offs for life.
Those of us who are making money, Carmen sneers.
Amelia rolls up the scroll in her small hands.
So how do we do that?
I don't know. We should get it appraised first.
You do that, Mimi.
Carmen says. You're good at getting things done.
The police give them back the gun. They own it, technically, by virtue of inheritance. But none of their names is on the permit. No one knows what to do with it. It sits on the buffet, huge and humming through the wooden crate. It has to be destroyed, like the ring that must be thrown into the volcano's caldera. But how? Mimi steals herself and takes the crate. She bungees it to the back carrier of her high school bicycle, which her parents have kept in the basement for years. Then she pedals down Pennsylvania toward the gun shop in Glen Ellen, where the firearm came from. She doesn't know if they'll buy it back. She doesn't care. She'll donate it to charity. The box is ungodly heavy on her rear carrier, and she wants it gone. Cars pass her, the drivers annoyed. The neighborhood is too affluent for adults on bicycles. The crate looks like a tiny coffin. Then, a police car. She tries to act normal, that thing the Ma family always pretended to be. The squad car crawls behind her, flashing lights invisible at noon. It pops the siren for a quarter second, a hiccup of ultimate authority. Mimi wobbles to a stop and almost tips over. Mandatory jail sentence for handguns you aren't licensed to carry. Gun recently wiped clean of so much human tissue. Her heart hits so hard she can taste the blood up under her tongue. The cop comes out and over to where she cowers on the bike.
You didn't signal back there.
Her head is quivering on its stalk. She can only let it bob.
Always use your hand signals. It's the law.
Then Mimi is at O'Hare, waiting for a flight back to Portland. She hears herself being paged over the airport speakers again and again. Each time she bolts upright, and each time the syllables turn back into other words. The flight is delayed, then delayed again. She sits twisting the jade tree around her finger tens of thousands of times. The things of this world mean nothing except for this ring and the priceless ancient scroll in her carry-on. She wants only peace. But this is where she must live now, in the shadow of the bent mulberry. The inexplicable poem, the fisherman's song.